peace women across the globe. A podcast about women's contribution to peace all over the world.
The basic mistake is the suffering and pain what women are going through, it can't be internalized from the men's perspective, you know. Men can be the feminist also, I agree, but this could have come out from the women's voices themselves. What are their needs, you know, what has to be included into the policies. I am Susan Rizal and I'm from Nepal, and I am the chief executive officer in my organization, and I started to lead this organization from 2011.
The revolution was started by the Maoists with their weapons mostly looted from the state security forces. They fought many a battle against
the
security forces
in this year. Violence escalated a lot after the palace massacre. And they are coming to the Kathmandu looking for the safer places. Especially youths and women were targeted by both the parties, from the Maoist and also from the state. Many more women were sexually abused also at that time. They were tortured, and youths were always, Maoist always wanted them to involve them as a cadre.
In media was even more dangerous. Journalist Gyanendra Khadga's murder is one of the brutal killings the country will always remember. His head was chopped off his body by the Maoists.
So they were running from their hometown and coming to Kathmandu, because Kathmandu, it is a kind of little bit safer places at that time. It was not attacked by the Maoists. So they were not getting any kind of space at that time. And my founder, and she's a very well-known, renowned feminist also, and she has also experience of doing developmental worker for 25 years, and she's a different personality also. And once she has invited in one of the organization's program, and she's just, you know, floated her idea, let's do something for the people who are displaced and coming to Kathmandu. Let's start the forum where people can come and tell their, you know, grief and trauma, express their trauma and grief, and ventilate their stress at some extent. That is how Nagarika was created, to provide the safe space for the people whereby they can come together. And they began to work in a very unbiased way. The victims from the Maoist and also victims from the state, they can come together and listen to their stories, and also internalize that they are not only the sufferer, others are also suffering from the same pain.
For years, the conflict was largely confined to remote rural areas, until 2001, when the newly crowned King Gyanendra let loose the Royal Nepalese Army, or RNA, on the insurgents. Overnight, the death toll rose dramatically. Human rights abuses escalated to unprecedented levels, and according to international human rights groups...
It is everywhere in the world, if you look at the data also, almost in any kind of armed conflict, 85% of the civilians are always targeted by the warring parties, and 90% of the women always targeted by the warring parties. Nepal being a patriarchal country, what happened? In 2001, the government also decided to mobilize the army to arrest the Maoist cadre. And they went to the jungle in a very mindset of militarization with the power of gun, and we are a patriarchal country also. And when they went to the villages, they didn't find the men within those homes. And they targeted the women. They sexually abused them also. They tortured them at that time. And it is also their strategy to spread the messages of fear, you know. If you are involved in the Into the Mouse movement, your family will be punished like this way. Initially, what was one alliance? It is called Association of Maoist Victims. And there was another organization called Orphanage for Terror Victims. We have that kind of coordination with them. And from them, they send those youths to our organization. And among youths, always there is a 70% of women. We also work with men as well. But 70% were women who lost their husbands, whose husbands were disappeared, who themselves were abducted or tortured in the time of conflict, and who were sexually abused in the time of conflict. That is how we created a space for themselves. And we used to do a kind of storytelling session, you know, about the incident. What we believe in that, if they carry the multi-layered trauma inside, it will not going to be helpful for them. They have to release those trauma. And we always used to say that the things what they shared in this room will be confidential and it will not go out after we discuss within our this spaces. And they, I don't know how they really trusted us the moment that, and that is how it also helped them to engage in this kind of peace processes also.
Human rights lawyer Mandira Sharma deals with these abuses on a daily basis.
Courts are not functioning properly. Court orders are not observed. Torture is being used very systematically and routinely. Extrajudicial killings are going on, and there is no investigations at all on those sort of cases. Victims of disappearances have faced the similar problems. There is no remedy for the victims. So we have been going through the worst time in terms of human rights.
These spaces really helped them for their personal transformation. We really wanted them to, you know, have that kind of transformation from feeling of revenge and anger to forgiveness and reconciliation. And I believe that that really helped on that part. And after having them in our 1 year long program, which we called it Displaced Youth Volunteer Program, and we also send the youths who wanted to go into the communities as a peace ambassador, we also send them as a peace ambassador in different working areas where we were working on in the time of fight and conflict. That's what the transformation, what I see within our youth through our programs. Because still we were in a direct armed conflict, and in that time, you know, many more organizations were also targeted by the Maoist party also, and they bombed those organizations also. And while we created a space, we used to do a kind of consultation meeting or the interaction meeting by inviting all the stakeholders like youths, the government people, the students, and just working, you know, just providing a space for the people, just providing a kind of safety net, providing little support. Let's say people are not getting any kind of support for their medical treatment, even for the cremation of their relatives at that time. We used to collect those money within the individual donors within Nepal, and we created an immediate relief. First, we'll just talk with them, not including with them. For women, it is very difficult to come out and expose themselves as a sexually abused woman. The sexuality is considered as a prestige issue from the family and also from the communities. They are thrown out from their houses because they were sexually abused in the time of conflict. They were blamed for the incidences, what has happened to them, whereas they haven't done anything. Generally, it's a patriarchal country, and a bigger normative framework of violence, you know, that violence has to be accepted by women, has to be there. It's also a part of the patriarchal culture also. That is the main reason that is why it is happening. I'm born in Kathmandu, and I studied in Kathmandu also. So I have four sisters. So I was born in an educated family. That was the fortunate part for me. And in Nepal, mostly, you know, when you look at the gender terms, mostly for those families who have, you know, sons or daughter, both are there. Mostly they used to admit their sons in boarding schools and the girls to the government school. But I am fortunate enough that I am born in an educated family. We studied in the same school where my cousin brothers were also studied. That is how I am fortunate enough. I'm also from the family, from the political background also, you know, though I didn't go into the politics, but some kind of liberal family I was born in. My cousin brother also studied in boarding schools, and I also get the privilege to study in the boarding school. We used to play, you know, always together. I also used to play football. They also used to play the other game, what women's plays. That is how I'm saying that I'm born in liberal family, and it is very fortunate for Nepali women like us. You know, normally it doesn't happen in Nepal. And also one of the thing that my mother was married at the age of 21. And she also understood the value of, you know, education. That is why also in terms of different kinds of hardship also, she always insisted us, the daughters, to pursue their educations also. That kind of attachment was there. Although my father decides, but there is some kind of inspiration was there from my mother also. So in the time of conflict, it was a very difficult moment for women. But in the other part, after the Maoist initiated their movement, almost 40% of the women also went as a first line combatant within the Maoist movement. And a kind of political awareness was raising in the time of conflict at that time. And after, in this post-conflict scenario, if we compare, it is the contribution of the Maoist movement. I have to also accept that also.
A decade ago, Kamala Thapa Magar never thought she'd become a farmer and live outside Kathmandu Valley. She was a member of Nepal's Maoist army and had dreams of a revolutionary change. But almost a decade after the war ended, Kamala can't return home.
12 years is a long time, and society has changed during this time, and so have we. After rejecting patriarchal views of our society, to go back and live there is difficult.
12 households of former Maoist fighters have started...
Because, you know, I have been working with these women from 16 years. Not only Maoist women, the women who are impacted by the armed conflict, and including the ex-combatants. And if I look back, the situation has really changed. But in the time of conflict, they went into the Maoist movement, especially the women. It is not by their interest only. They are also forced to join in their movements. And also with the feelings of taking revenge to the government also, because their husbands were killed by the Maoist party. And there were also the lots of aspiration was made by the Maoist party. What they just send, they spread the messages. After they come to the power, there will be no inequality, there will be no discrimination, there will be no poverty. That is how, and women, especially from the indigenous community, who were discriminated in the time before the conflict, like the Dalits women, the Chaudhary women, who are always been discriminated from our state structure, they really participated into the Maoist movement. And the aspiration which was being made is not being fulfilled at this moment.
The Comprehensive Peace Agreement ended the 10-year-long war in November 2006. The deal highlighted the importance for justice and accountability for Nepalese affected by the conflict. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission has received more than 50,000 complaints since it was constituted 19 months ago.
Yeah, it was said into the comprehensive peace accord, into the, I think it is into the Article 7. It also talks about, you know, it will deal with the structural causes of the conflict, and also the person who did the unlawful actions will be also investigated with the formulation of Truth and Reconciliation Commission and Investigation on Disappearance Commissions. But it didn't happen. The aspiration was what has been women's were aspiring after the peace occurred. There will be the justice, there will be a space to live with dignity. This has not been, not yet, still in this post-conflict scenario. That's what we have been, no for them.
Prosecutions, and we are kind of ignoring other pillars of transitional justice like truth-seeking, reparations, institutional reforms. And this is what
almost, 17,000 people were killed at that time, and 9,000 were being widowed at that time. You can, if you look at the exact number, 9,000 were being widowed. And there are lots of tortured and sexual abuse also has happened, but there is no data. So our government collected those data, but they just failed to, go into other kind of incidents. That what I see, that there was no mainstreaming gender while they were formulating the policies and plans. The women who are sexually abused are also, for us, they are affected women. But our interim compensation policies didn't recognize women who face sexual violence in the time of conflict, and they're not been, provided any kind of compensation from the state structures. While the peace negotiation was happening, or while the peace agreement was happening, there is no participation of the women at that time. Zero. There was no participation of the women at that time. I don't know what make that moments, but the policy, what has been formulated, it is by men. But they just didn't, think in kind of holistic way. In a war, such kind of incidences might have happened. They have never thought about this. That is why also women were excluded. There is a United Nations Security Council Resolution 1325 and 1820. It is also formulated, the National Action Plan. But it recognized the women who face sexual violence in the time of conflict as the conflict victims. And you can see the contradict between the two policies. Both the policies was formulated in the leadership of Peace Ministry. But while making the 1325 and 1820, many more women-led organizations were also consulted. Many more women who were affected by the conflict were also consulted. But while the interim compensation policies was formulating, none of the government women-led organization or the conflict victims were consulted. It is just from the, thought of the men who joined the justice, what I see. Almost 400 cases of the torture has been collected. Truth and Reconciliation Commission was collecting the cases of the wartime incidences. They assigned to collect those wartime cases to local peace committees. And the local peace committees, there are lots of male members were there. And there was no counseling room for the women. And most of the what we have heard, that most of the local peace committee members, what they also say to the women, that they have to show the evidence, and they say, and they just return back without complaining their wartime incidents into the, that is how you can imagine that our systems and structure, how it compelled women to not to go into this process also. And many of the women didn't go into this process also because of the security, and also not only from the security personnel, but also fear of, dismantling of their families also. Thank you. Normally, what I experienced that while I went to have an interview with the security personnel, they explicitly didn't say that this kind of incidents was happen. They say this might have happened, you know. They know that that incidences was happened, you know. But they say, in my command, it never happened. But I think this might have happened. This might be a rumor or this might have happened. But they, from their expression, I can sense that they know that the incidences was happened and what could be the possibilities for establishing a dignity and justice. They are also saying creating a space for the people, you know. That kind of thing they are saying, the psychosocial component also. They say that, but they didn't explicitly say that it was happened while the security personnel were mobilized.
The war only ended when the new king finally agreed to cede power. The next few years saw several back and forth struggles between the Communist Party and the majority parties. This struggle finally culminated
in the peace accord. It also say that the state will also go into the addressing the structural causes of the conflict. And from 2006 also, we are observing many transition in our country. Let's say we abolished monarchy. We were announced as a secular state. We went to the federal country. And we also faced mega earthquake in 2015. And those incidents really excluded the priority of the, you know, addressing to the structural causes of the conflict. What I always say that our government was just trying to stick into, you know, establishing the liberal peace. That means that, you know, just institutionalizing the big structures or policy, not going into the structural causes of the conflict, not going into the democratic process of the conflict. This is where we are. It's all about patriarchy. Because it's a mindset, you know, still has to work on shifting the attitude and behavior of the people. And as a peace builder, I always believe in those part also. Without changing the attitude and behavior of the people, we can't go into, you know, shifting the real transformation, what we aspire. After the local election, there are many women are into the local structures as the vice mayor, but their conditions are very much fragile, you know. When they come out being little late, they were, you know, blamed by their husbands about their characters. They have been beaten by the husband. Still, it is there, you know. So there has to be shift into the attitude and behavior. We talk about women empowerment, women awareness. Mostly what we did that we just accumulated the women and talk about the empowerment issues or the rights issues without mostly engaging the men in our programs. That's what I see, you know. We are talking with the women about their incidences, sufferings, always, you know, creating a space for them. But we have not given a space for those conflict-affected women to have a dialogue with the non-affected, conflict-affected people so that they can also internalize the suffering of the women and also can say that that was not the mistake of the women, so that it can also help for their social establishment. As I told you that after the peace accord, it has been really changed actually in terms of the political participation of the women, in terms of the political awareness of the women. But while at the constitutional making, because of the lobby of the women's movement, you know, the women-led organization, women are also a part of, huge part of the constitution-making process also. That is why we get that kind of, you know, rights within the constitution that at least 33% of women has to be into the constitutional bodies, and 40% has to be into the local structure bodies, and we gain it also, you know. So there is a huge contributions of the women's movement while women come together, you know, for, because everybody was very much tired of the armed conflict. But still, we need to work a lot at the level of implementation level, you know, in our policies and constitution. It also recognized the, you know, contributions of the women at the policy level. But at the practical level, it is still not having. But we have changed a lot. Maybe in South Asia, if I look back, Nepal is really progressive on that part. But in terms of structural issues, in terms of liberal issues, we are there. But not at the structural issues, where we still need to go a long way. That what I have been learning from other peace women across the globe is also they are giving continuity for their work. Although there are lots of, there are moments for the frustration, you know, burnout, but still there is some kind of compassion among those women, and they're doing it, continuously doing it, and peace work requires this. It's a very time-consuming and resource-consuming process, but your tireless effort is very necessary if you are talking about building peace within your community. And I have been observing those kind of compassion within our peace women across the group. And also that also motivates us, each other, you know. We also need those kind of spaces, not only for the women. We also need those spaces where we can also energize ourselves. Okay, somebody is doing that, we should also do this kind of thing. That's what we have been learning from each other.
Women across the globe. A podcast about women's contribution to peace all over the world. This is a production of podcastlab.ch in collaboration with a non-governmental organization, Peace Women Across the Globe. Peace Women Across the Globe is on Spotify, iTunes, and on the website 1000peacewomen.org. Please do send us your feedback.